The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I want you to get up now.
Get him off.
Go to the window.
Leave him on.
Stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Build your guts to the grand jury.
Say it isn't so, self-control.
Hey, we wash our own laundry around here.
I don't care if I'm in trouble. I don't care who gets it anymore, including myself.
I'm a marked man in this department for what?
Will you help me?
I can win it. I can win this case.
Have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery.
Now, come on.
What you doing?
And will you get back
over
there?
Director Sidney Lumet died on April 9th, 2011. The director of such classic films as 12 Angry Men, Network, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, and The Verdict was known for his intense flair for gritty realism and his ability to pull some of the greatest performances from many of our finest actors. In this retrospective episode, we speak to two of those actors, Chris Sarandon, who made his film debut opposite Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon, and Colm Feore, a stunning character actor whose additional credits include the TV series 24 and The Insider, who played opposite Andy Garcia in Sidney Lumet's New York cop drama Night Falls on Manhattan.
I was the one who wanted to get married. He didn't really want it, but he did it. I don't know why.
Well, why did you want to get married, Leah?
I thought it would help me. But it didn't. I was so confused. I was doing insane things.
What sort of things, Leah?
After the wedding, I ran off for 10 days to Atlantic City. Sonia was frantic. He knew I'd been drinking. He didn't know where I was, who I was with. Well, I couldn't explain the things I did. So I went to a psychiatrist who told me that I was a woman trapped in a man's body.
I knew Sidney Lumet sort of socially from my ex-wife Susan, who had worked with him on a movie, and I also knew Al Pacino socially because his at the time, I guess, ex-girlfriend and I were in a show together, a Broadway show, so we all kind of knew each other, but my agent sent me up for it, so it wasn't as if it was a you know, Sidney didn't call me or Al didn't call me or anything. That was, it was really just a straight audition that my agent set up, and I went in. You know, we said hello and how you doing and everything, and then I sat down and read.
So were Lumet and Pacino there in the readings?
Oh yeah. You know, it's one of the great things about Al as an actor is that, you know, when they're, I mean, I don't know what it's like for him for most of his movies, but I assume it would be the same because he's such a conscientious team player. Is yeah. That he's always there because he wants to know, as does Sidney in this case. They want to know what the chemistry is like between the actors, and it was very important, particularly in this case, even though the two characters didn't appear on screen together. Mm-hmm. They had such a rich and bizarre history together that it was important to ascertain whether there was a chemistry between the actors.
What were your initial impressions upon reading it? Were you?
When I first read the script, I thought, first of all, it's a great script. Yeah. And in fact, it won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay that year for Frank Pearson, who wrote the screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
It was a story that had was very unusual for the time. If you think back to that period in the 70s, when the whole gay rights movement really didn't exist, when AIDS was yet to come to the forefront as being one of the great healthcare tragedies of our time, when gay marriage didn't exist, you know, there was it was a real groundbreaking in many ways story, and not because it was about a gay relationship necessarily. It was about a human relationship gone sour,
mm-hmm.
and also a rather comic and ultimately tragic bank robbery gone sour.
Yeah.
So it was a very unusual piece. But at the same time, it was obvious from first reading that it was an extraordinary piece.
Well, you're right about that, because I mean the movie is so many things. It's about so many things. But in terms of the portrayal of the gay relationship, I mean that really hadn't been explored in mainstream film before.
Right. Never.
Yeah. So what's very groundbreaking in that?
Yeah.
In that?
Yeah. Definitely.
Was this taken from actual events, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. There was a bank robbery in which the protagonist of the story, played by Al in this case, he was given a fictional name in the movie, but
right.
The real character went in and robbed a bank, and it was discovered through this rather bizarre media circus that occurred when the robbers were trapped in the bank with the employees of the bank, that the bank robbery was initiated because the main character was trying to get money for a sex change operation for his boyfriend. And
yeah.
It became a major kind of media event in New York City. I don't know that it was necessarily a national one. I wasn't around. I mean, I wasn't in New York at the time. But I do remember it was a major media circus. It was covered very much as it's portrayed in the movie by all the major news outlets in New York. It was a big event in the city.
Yeah. So did you have any kind of dialogue with your real life counterpart?
No. We all talked about that during rehearsals, whether we wanted to really access the real people or not. And the decision was made that it's close enough to real events. We had any number of articles that were written about the story, and in fact, now that I think of it, it was a national story, because I know that there was a Life magazine article about the event. There were some photographs that we all used that were taken from the media at the time. We all used the material that was available to us, but we felt that getting in touch with and talking to the real characters was maybe just crossing a line that we didn't want to cross.
Yeah, but you did mention a rehearsal process, and I think this is what really makes Sidney Lumet special, because
yeah.
he always
yeah,
allows
yeah.
for a rehearsal process. What is
yeah.
it? Tell me about that process and what that gave you.
Well, essentially what Sidney does, and he did at least in this picture, and I know he does it with his other movies, is he rehearses it very much like a play. You have, I believe we had approximately 3 weeks of rehearsal for Dog Day, and the set was laid out on the floor with a taped floor plan for each set. And I mean, obviously, the main set was the actual interior of the bank, and so you knew exactly what the spatial relationships that you were dealing with were, and you rehearsed it for 3 weeks is a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
you work through scene by scene. In my case, the character is actually, just in terms of screen time, fairly minor. I mean, I think somebody told me once that the character's on screen for something like 11 minutes of the entire running of the movie. So I wasn't around every day, but the days that I was there, I can attest to the fact that the work that we did was very intense, very detailed. And in fact, the telephone scene, Al and I particularly felt, and I think Sidney concurred, that the scene itself was a wonderful scene in its outline, but that in its in its specifics, it was somewhat melodramatic and not really very true to life. Mm. And one of the other things that Sidney is very open about is improvisation. While this was a brilliant script, and every bit of it was worthy of the Academy Award that Frank Pearson won, that there was, at least in our case, the telephone scene we felt needed some tweaking. And Sidney said, well, what do you think? And Al and I started talking, and we just started going into the scene in a kind of improvisatory way. But what we did was we incorporated all the information and the material that Frank Pearson had created for the scene, but just kind of reordered it and threw in a few things here and there. And after we finished, Sidney said, hold on. And he went and got somebody to come and transcribe to tape the scene as we had done it in the improvisation. So we did it again, and then we talked about what we had done, and Sidney said, well, you know, this is something that we need to leave in, or what about if we leave this out, or you could reorder this, and then we do it again. And we did, as I recall, a number of versions of the scene that were recorded, and then they sent them out to be transcribed, and then all of us got together, the producers, Marty Elfand and Marty Bregman, and Sidney and Al and me, and I believe Frank was there too, and we just, you know, looked at all the versions of the scenes that we had done. I think we threw out a couple of them, and then we kind of, you know, got together and put together the scene.
Do you recall any of those moments that you found in that improv within that scene?
I think the allusion to I'm just trying to think. I mean, I'd have to sort of watch the scene. I mean,
yeah.
I could do an audio commentary for you. Oh yeah, that moment Al came up with in the improv. That was I just threw that in at one of them. I can't be very specific, but I do know that there were a number of things that we kind of threw in here and there. But you know, it was essentially Frank's scene. But
mm-hmm.
we it was kind of the variations on a theme by Frank Pearson, that scene.
So tell me, and obviously the rehearsal process was very valuable, I mean, just for that fact alone.
Oh, tremendously, yeah.
But there's a counter-argument that it kind of it takes away from the sense of discovery or spontaneity when you're actually doing it on the set.
Much to the contrary, and I think when you talk to any theater actor, they'll tell you the same thing, and that is that, I mean, my theory, and this is just, you know, Chris Sarandon's cockamamie theory about movie acting, is that when you get into trouble is in the middle ground, when you've had some rehearsal, but you're not really solid, so that you don't feel like you can kind of fly, because you're not thinking about words, you're not thinking about situations, you're just thinking in the moment. And the two extremes are no rehearsal when you're just really flying by the seat of your pants, and lots of rehearsal when you're so solid that you can fly by the seat of your pants.
Yes.
But you have the added dimension of feeling so secure with the material that you don't think about it. You don't worry about it. And to me, it's the middle ground that's the problem. When you've rehearsed a little bit and you're kind of okay, and you're not really flying by the seat of your pants because you're neither here nor there. So in my mind, going back to the comment I made about theater actors, is that if you talk to people, and it's happened to me, who have done a run of a play for, say, 9 months or 6 months or whatever, and, you know, I have people who have said to me, God, how can you do it night after night? But it's always changing, because particularly when you're working with good actors, those moments are always, you know, you look at somebody and something's different that night. Something they bring to the performance that evening has changed it. And it literally does change from moment to moment. And so the spontaneity, I think, is not a problem. And for instance, you know, you look at Al Pacino, who is one of our great actors. And Al, you know, he likes to do 30 takes. Sometimes.
And he likes to throw you some curveballs,
by the way. What?
he likes to throw you some curveballs in there too, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, we all, you know, that's the fun of doing it, is that you're you're playing. I mean, and your metaphor of using the baseball parallel is very apt, because, you know, a pitcher gets up there, he's got his repertoire, he knows he's going to throw a four-seam fastball or a two-seamer, he's where he wants to throw it, the catcher's prepared for it, but the human element enters in always, and the script is while the script is being followed, you know how you want to pitch to the batter, the ball doesn't always go exactly where you want it to, and so you have to adapt to midair, literally, and that's, I think, a very apt metaphor for what goes on in acting.
I am. Anyone that knows anything about me, Al Pacino is he's quite a hero for me, and so I relish every opportunity I have to ask about him. Did you spend a lot of time with him, developing a relationship with him, or?
Well, actually, what happened was, because we were not up right away with our scenes. That is the scenes that Al was most of the time shooting. At least prior to the time that I actually did my scenes, we had a lot of time, and we didn't want to lose that sense of being solid in the scene that we had. And so he and I would get together whenever he had an opportunity, because I wasn't doing anything; he was the one who was working. And we'd get together. You know, I think maybe we got together two or three times from the time we rehearsed to the time we actually shot, and just ran the scene. So, yeah, we did get together. I think I went over to his place a few times, and we just run it easily a few times, and then, I'll see you in a few days, and then we'd get together again whenever we'd have the opportunity and run it again.
Mm. I know that we mentioned the rehearsal process. Another one of Lumet's strengths, I find, that I've heard from others, is that it's probably the most important, is about creating an environment in which the actor can feel safe and can thrive.
Right.
How did he do that for you in this film?
Well, I think it's just the way Sidney works. Part of it is the fact that he allows you that rehearsal period to discover things and find things, and to create a kind of actor-friendly atmosphere. It's always around. You know, he listens, he watches, he learns. Mm-hmm. It's a constant sort of symbiotic process. You know, you're constantly trading information, talking, discovering, and also it's interesting too, because one of the byproducts of this rehearsal process is that Sidney always finishes his movies on time and on budget, and sometimes under.
Yeah.
And it's not a function of his being in a rush, but of being prepared. Mm. And that's not only from the standpoint of Sidney knowing what he wants to shoot, how he wants to shoot it. He doesn't waste a lot of coverage. He knows how he wants to cover scenes going in. And so you have the sense that, you know, we're going to get this done. We've already done the work in the rehearsal room, and all we got to do is get out there and fly on the set. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very liberating kind of way of working.
When you're actually shooting this scene, and I want to get back to Mr. Lumet too, and what sets him apart as a director. But was Pacino actually on the other end of that phone? Were you actually playing?
Oh yeah, we both were. I would come in. I came in and did the my end of the phone scene for Al when he was on camera, and he did his end of it on my on camera as well. Yeah, I mean that's something that's a given. When you work with Sidney, you don't do off-camera stuff where, you know, somebody takes a few hours off and somebody reads the lines off-camera for the actor. You know, the actors are always there for each other. That's just the way he works, and the way most of the actors that he works with works. You know, there's nobody takes a time off when somebody else is on camera.
Absolutely. And I know I'm hiding it in my voice, but I'm absolutely giddy asking you about this scene, because it's honestly, it's one of the most astonishing scenes I've ever seen in an astonishing movie, just a Time Vault classic movie that means a lot to me. Tell me more about Lumet, because this must have been something that your first time, it had to have spoiled you. You had to have thought that every movie would be.
Yeah, what do you do after that? Yeah, I've never, obviously not before, because it was my first feature. But never since have I had that, quite that kind of experience where, you know, I mean, I've had experiences where I've loved working with the actors, loved working with the director, but never one in which the preparation was so detailed and specific, and never one where the creative atmosphere was so so rife and was so wonderful in terms of preparing one for going on the set and doing the movie. It does spoil you.
Yeah, but not only by working with him, but also by, you know, being a fan of his movies, which I'm sure you are, as all of us are.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is your take on what makes him one of the greatest directors?
Well, I think I've probably talked about most of them, and that is his receptivity, his preparedness, his ability to synthesize ideas and to create an atmosphere in which actors feel very much at home. Particularly, you know, he's a New York director. I think that's very clear about Sidney Lumet, and from New York, born, bred. As I recall, Sidney was an actor when he was younger in the Yiddish theater and in other venues, and so you, as an actor, feel very much that you're being taken care of, but not necessarily coddled, because he listens, he challenges, he wants to know what you think, but he's the ultimate authority. So it's not as if you have a feeling, well, I can just do whatever the hell I want, because Sidney will say, you know what, that doesn't really work. I mean, he does it in a very lovely and sweet and loving manner, but he makes his wishes very clear.
His films have touched our conscience and challenged our minds. Now, one of the greatest directors of our time pushes the limits again.
Whose father is laying up there with tubes coming out of every hole he's got? And who put him there?
Between truth and corruption.
Cops from three precincts were in business with my client.
Guilt.
I'm saddened to announce the indictment this morning of five police officers on charges of bribery and dealing in narcotics.
And innocence.
If their lips are moving, they're lying.
Conviction and compromise.
It wasn't supposed to happen to me.
It's not supposed to happen to any of us.
Andy Garcia, Richard Dreyfuss.
Swear to me right here, Pop! You're clean.
Night falls on Manhattan.
One of the things that was clear from just watching Sidney's films was that he loves actors. And because he loves actors, he gets extraordinary performances from them. And when I had a chance to audition for him, first for Night Falls on Manhattan, I leapt at it, and I got the blessing of my great aunt in New York City, Irish woman who'd lived there 50 years, and she dressed me up proper and sent me out, and she died just before I got in for the audition. And Sidney Lumet offered me the part in the room. And that never happens. I mean, it just simply never happens. And if it does, it's only happened to me once, and it was him. And so, consequently, I had to say to him, you know, it's my great aunt who's working on this right now, Sidney. But because he loves actors, because because he's been an actor, and he loves the whole process of acting, he is sympathetic, empathetic. He knows how to push actors to get more out of them than they knew they had, and he just relishes it. To sit and watch Sidney watching actors work, you know, sitting between two cameras that are both rolling on, you know, two people having a two-hander scene, it's just unbelievable.
Tell me what that does. I want to ask about his process and a lot of things that you've just brought up, but since you brought up the cameras, two cameras.
Well, Sidney's renowned for being a very, very fast and very, very prepared. I've known people who've gone on location scouts with him 6 months before he came to this remote location. He's gone to an open field and said, "We'll be here on a 50." And the 6 months later have arrived. They drive into the set. He goes to the open field. Everything's changed. Snow has fallen. Spring has sprung. He goes, "We're here on a 50." And that kind of efficiency. I remember the first day, the first shot of Night Falls on Manhattan, He had a 600-millimeter lens down the hall, I think at City Hall, and Ron Liebman was standing on a table giving some superlative acting, as only he can do. And Sidney Lumet, with all these, you know, 300 extras, everybody acting their heads off, first take, first shot, cut, print, move on. The stunned look on everybody's face, what do you mean, move on? And they all went, oh, my God, this guy's not kidding. We have to be ready. We have to be out of the trailers and acting right from the get-go because there is no looking back. And he set the tone instantly. And I asked him at some point, I said, Sidney, what is the key to your vaunted speed? And, you know, obviously he's written the book on how to make movies. He knows what he's doing. But he said, listen, on reflection, from a really good crew, my crew, I can get maybe 12 hours, you know, of concentrated work. From a good actor, if they're doing the job properly, 10 tops. Anything beyond that, I'm pushing my luck and I'm not getting anything. So it's just about knowing exactly what you want when you get in there, having actors who know what they want to do. At one point in the rehearsal, because keep in mind with Sidney, you don't just show up like you got the job on Friday, you show up Monday and you're acting. We did right. 2 weeks of rehearsal in the same yeah. rehearsal hall that Newman had used, that everybody, you know, it's at the Ukrainian Fires Hall downtown. And it was ridiculous because a bunch of us were staying at the Sherry Netherland. It was me, Ian Holm, and I was like starstruck like crazy, Richard Dreyfuss. And we all got down in the Sherry Netherland on the same elevator. And I had to say, hi, I'm Colin Fuhr, and you're Richard Dreyfuss. But of course, you know that. And it was just awkward and silly. And Ian Holm, I've just been a huge fan of forever. So I was really kind of mealy-mouthed. And I said, oh, we're going to go out. We're going to rehearsal. And I thought, we're going to go out. We jump in the van and we go down. I go out. There's three town cars. We can't get in together. We all have to get into the separate town cars to drive to the, you know, Ukrainian or Hungarian Fireman's Hall downtown on 2nd Avenue and up to the, you know, the past the pissoir to the taped-out rehearsal hall floor. And James Gandolfini is there, and everybody's, you know, ready to go. Andy Garcia walks to the corner of the room, and he looks out over this tape mark on the floor and says, Sidney, I'd like to, you know, take this character, take this moment and walk over here and look out this window. And Sidney says, it's a great idea. I didn't build that wall. Think of something else. And that was it. And so Andy went, oh, okay, I'll turn that around in the rest of the room and we'll shoot that.
Wow. I'm fascinated by this rehearsal process, and we actually asked Chris Sarandon earlier in the show about it. You know, all actors need different things, I would think. What do you need as an actor, and how did Lumet give that to you?
Well, one of the things that he did was he really embraced all the actors and all the different acting styles. Keep in mind, around our table on the first day, Lena Olin, and I mean, I don't think it's too much to say she was nursing and Lasse Hallström was hiding in a back room. That it was too delicious for words. But you had Lena Olin, Andy Garcia, Ian Holm, Ron Liebman, James Gandolfini, Richard Dreyfuss. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was truly ridiculous. Yeah. And we had Sidney's daughter, who was playing one of the young romantic interests. I mean, it was unbelievable. And what he said, it was so generous. He looked around the table and he said, look, everybody here, almost every one of you to a man or a woman, has a different acting style, has come at this from a different way. We're going to embrace all of that. We're going to allow everybody their way to find their way, but we've got to make a family, and this is how we're going to do it. And so that was the first step, and it was so generous and so, you know, so welcoming that everybody just thought, fine. So Andy's, you know, Cuban but Irish, but of, you know, and Ian Holm is English, is Irish, and Lena is going to be, you know, and everybody just simply went, fine, Ron Liebman, I got it. And, you know, give me a cheesy hairpiece. I understand what's going on. I will say something funny because we did a take. Me and Andy were doing there's the debate scene where we're going for DA. And we've got like 300 extras again, and we do the whole thing. And again, after the first take, he shouts, cut, print, move on. And he goes, no, what do you, listen, it takes me at least, you know, 17, you know, seven takes to warm up. I like to do maybe 17. I like to do this. I like to do that. And And Sidney, you know, he said, I got it. I said, you know, it's a wide lens, a long lens. I'm back. I know what I want. This is just this little piece, and we're going to move in. But Andy really wanted to get it right. And
right.
So after much humming and hawing, Sidney said, all right, we'll go again for Andy. But keep in mind, I got to watch all this boring shit. And Garcia went, okay, I get it. But Ron Liebman would go, Sidney, it's not right now. Boom. And he actually broke his hand pounding the desk one day. He just actually just went that far. But he would get a third, maybe a fourth, even maybe a fifth take. Finally, Garcia says, so what, you got to be Jewish and from New York to get a third take on this picture? And at that point, Sidney actually went, okay, Andy, one more for you, just for free. Go ahead.
I want to ask you about Rob Liebman, because he is a powerhouse in this movie. He owns the space that he's given, and he's really in your face in a couple of scenes. What is that like?
I have to say, I was a little younger then too. I was intimidated by Ron. He's such a generous and wonderfully supportive guy. He the first thing he said to me was he was a huge fan of a little Canadian film called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, and he'd seen it. He'd actually seen it, you know. So that made him rare among my parents and Ron. So I was disarmed, and then he started acting, and of course I was blown away. But he was very generous. I mean, we all knew it was acting, you know. So you embrace it, you stand for it, and you say, "Listen, whatever you want to bring, I'll try and be there." And you know, I just was a little worried my bow tie would be crooked.
Yeah,
because the way he was, he'd scream at me.
Yeah, just the sound waves alone would.
Yeah.
Let me get your take on this. The rehearsal process, I'm sure it's a great luxury. Is there still moments of discovery when you're actually doing it on the set?
Absolutely. There's nothing to discuss because there's a spontaneity. I mean, I just had the great pleasure and privilege of working on a Clint Eastwood picture. I did The Changeling.
Yes.
And I said, listen, he's a lot like Sidney. And, it's three takes. We shoot the rehearsal. We move on. I never actually got lunch on the picture because we were always wrapped before we got to it.
And so beautiful.
It's extraordinary. But again, it's guys who know what they want, who, and as Eastwood said, I don't want to rob you of the spontaneity the first time you do it. So if you can shoot the rehearsal, shoot the rehearsal. Because you're ready. Listen, you auditioned. You already know the lines. So bring your best in, first out. Because after 3, 4, 5, you're going to get tired. Something's going to be lost in translation here.
Right.
And that is precisely what happened with Sidney. You'd have worked it out, and you could say to him, where there wasn't a crew standing by, there were no producers looking over people's shoulders, look, Sidney, what do you think if I do this? He goes, you know what? No, not so much. I didn't build that wall. There is no window there. Or I don't think the character would do that. And it's not costing anybody anything. And it's a creative process so that when you show up on the set on the day that, your scene is actually booked, you know exactly what's going on. And if we need to adjust, everybody's so ready and his team of people are so familiar with his style that if you want to change something on the fly, everybody's willing to go for it. So you capture magical, spontaneous moments just because you were all ready.
Yeah, and
does that make any sense?
Makes perfect
sense.
Oh, yeah. You are fantastic. You're answering 20 of my questions, and I've only asked one or two. So.
I'm sorry, that is a problem I have.
It's infectious. Thank God for it. You've been on many sets, so how do those differ from a Lumet set? I mean, would a Lumet set spoil you if you know?
Yeah, and listen, I have to say, I am very blessed, and I worked for Sidney very early on in my film career. I had a big theater career, something that Sidney understood and appreciated, and that's part of the thing, preparation, because you're live. Well, listen, you're live in front of 100 crew, and you're live in front of the director who sits there on a stool watching every moment and appreciating every moment and looking for these new discoveries as well as the seeds that he's already planted. And so his sets are glorious, not to mention the fact that they're really quick. He would do 2-unit moves on the streets of New York and be out by 2:45 on a Friday afternoon. You'd beat the traffic. And maybe it's because he wanted to get to his place in Connecticut. Maybe. I don't know. The fact of the matter was he got what he needed, and I did ask him again. I said, listen, Sidney, is there nothing that would make you do another take? He said, if it's a technical flaw but the acting is perfect, I won't go back. If there's something and a sound man says, I would like a little better sound, he said, I know really good guys with razors who are experts in their field who will do the best sound reconstruction. I'm fine with that. Because if the performance is there, the rest will follow. And
well, it's obvious that it's not a compromise from watching his work. There's no weak performance in a Lumet film.
And he is brutally honest. He is nothing if not honest. He lets nothing pass. So, you know, if you think, oh, I might be able to get away with this, he won't have noticed this, he'll stop and go, that's not quite, no, sorry, no. Just no.
Wow.
And because you've done so much work in the rehearsal, you start in the ballpark. It's not like you have to get to take 27 before you're anywhere close to what he wants. He saw what he wanted in the audition. He saw more of what he wanted, hopefully, and refined it in the rehearsals. When you show up and it's actually costing real production dollars, and of course, the fact of the matter was, we were so good, we were so fast. And keep in mind, we had a big cast, lots of locations, he was all over town. He still finished a week and a half early. The producers would beg him, go to Central Park, shoot some taxis. It looks like we asked for too much money. Just shoot, you know, idle life, wandering by. He says, no, thanks, I'm going to the country, I'm done. And they tore their hair out because they knew he'd be a week and a half early and $2 or $3 million under budget, and they'd look like they were greedy, you know. But it was, I was fascinated by the whole process. I mean, I'm a photographer in the hobby life because it helps, you know, figure out how to be, you know, more able to serve the process on a film set. And I said, well, now, Sidney, it's not as simple as simply rehearsing. He said, well, I asked the cinematographer. And both occasions I worked for him, we had the extraordinary David Watkins, and also known as Wendy Watkins in the trade. And he would say, listen, I speak to the cinematographer. He said, if I shoot this direction now, what's going to happen to the sunshine and you and your lights? Well, governor, as David Watkins would say, if you do that to me, it'll take me 3 hours after lunch to relight this. Very well, then, what we'll do is we'll block shoot the whole day's work from this side of the table. Which means, I mean, there's a scene in Critical Care where, you know, a bunch of lawyers meet and Kira Sedgwick is doing one thing or another. I forget exactly how it went, but table shots are terribly difficult to do. And if you were to shoot all of the actors, I think Ed Herman, myself, and Kathy Bates, and a whole bunch of people on one side of the table, then we have to do all our day's acting in the morning because then we're going to switch the lights over and do everybody else's acting on the other side. That requires people who know what they're doing. In the finished film, you'll never know the difference. But it meant we saved 3.5 hours of people sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
He's amazing craftsman, mm-hmm. he is.
But it's really, I mean, the real focus on craft and preparation allows you remarkable freedom in the execution. Because, of course, you've actually bought yourself the time to go, you know what? Take a steady cam and just wander over there. I remember doing The Insider. Michael Mann had 2 or 3 cameras set up. We were acting our heads off. It was all great. He saw something else he wanted. He raised his arm. He clicked his fingers, and he said, and, you know, his guys knew what that meant. They threw a camera on his shoulders, and some of the stuff spinning around Al is Michael. I need another camera. There's something I see I can get here. And everybody played ball. Cinematographer went fine. I mean, Tom Stern on the Eastwood thing, Eastwood doesn't say cut. He barely says, okay, that's enough. So if he doesn't say cut, people keep acting. But, of course, he hasn't lit the whole thing. So, you know, trying to catch Angelina Jolie with a great big reflector, and the cinematographer himself is carrying it around. The Steadicam operator is moving with it. I see where the camera's going. I know what the lens is. I know what they're working on. I say, I can participate in this. Obviously, he loves what's going on. Carry on. We just keep going.
There is something, though, thematically that's very similar in some of Lumet's films, and we've spoken about it earlier in the show, how you try to come out unscathed in kind of a morally corrupt environment. And, you know, Nightfalls, law enforcement, critical care, health care. Was there any discussion of a theme around the table, or was it just creating the moments as an actor?
Well, no, obviously, I mean, and the body of his work in Prince of the City and all of that stuff, and, you know, Serpico, it's something that has kept him busy and interested for pretty much his whole career. But decency, morality, you know, human beings trying in a difficult situation and circumstances to do the right thing. Obviously, those of us who signed on knew we were looking at those kind of stories, so he didn't have to beat us over the head with that.
Right, right. And the fact that he's now...
And Sheikh Mahmoud Bey, who was just staggering in it. You know?
Yeah.
And listen, keep in mind, there was a wonderful moment where we were rehearsing down on 2nd Avenue, and Shake was giving this remarkable performance, and just he was busting out all over, and it was a little bit frightening. And we heard this extraordinary noise on the street. And people said, come on back, because I think, I don't know if Lena was nursing in the back room, looked over the street, and our rehearsal was a little further away. It was a celebration going on the street. It was the day O.J. was acquitted. And the streets were going mental.
Mm.
And, of course, this, you know, this cloud just came over the room. Dreyfus, who's, of course, very political and very, you know, and had been.
Yeah.
Dreyfus was, I think, he, if memory serves, he was a guest of Judge Ito's on one of those days. It was just, it was just, you know, life imitating art, imitating life, imitating
mm-hmm.
art. And suddenly we thought, this has value, this has relevance, this is difficult.
Mm. And he'll use that too. I mean, he savors those accidents and that spontaneity. I've heard in a big way. Tell me about your thoughts on his longevity. I mean, this is unprecedented. He's 83 years old. He's just directed one of the great movies of his career, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. What do you attribute that to?
You know what? He leads a healthy life, I'm sure, and he loves the work, and he's, you know, I think to a degree he's pure of heart and spirit. He knows what he's fighting for, and I think he knows what he's living for, and
mm-hmm.
he doesn't seem to have ever taken a wrong step in terms of doing what it is that moves him, and what he wants to do, what he feels is correct to do. You know, there was 100 Center Street, which was a big undertaking because, of course, it was television and meant
mm-hmm.
you know, being there all the time.
Right.
You know? So I think that stuff keeps him alive. I bumped into him. I was doing a play on Broadway not too long ago with Denzel Washington. We were doing a Julius Caesar there in the summer of 2005. And I was living on the Upper West Side, and, of course, that's where he lives. And I was walking down the street, and there was Sidney. And I thought, oh, he won't remember me. I said, Mr. Lamette. He said, yes, of course, I remember you. I said, you hired me a couple of times. I played lawyers. What a surprise. But, you know, I just wanted to thank him for being,
sure.
you know, kind enough to, you know, hire me, to believe in me, to just, you know, be there for me. And he looked exactly the same as he had whenever it was I'd seen him last, which was, you know, a dozen years before. You know, so clearly it's good living and hard work.
Right.
Down. And she's far away somewhere. In her eyes are down.
Future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.